This is Indie Book Publishing. Indie Book Publishing is a show about new books and the authors who wrote them. It's an opportunity for prospective readers to hear directly from the writers, to hear what inspired them to write and publish, and to hear all the inside details about their books. And now, Indie Book Publishing.
For our next book, we enter the sometimes complicated world of dating, relationships, and love. Are you sick of meeting the wrong guy? Do you feel social pressure to be in a relationship? Do you find yourself settling for safety because it's easier than being alone? Do you feel like you're not attractive enough for your ideal partner? Well, my next guest, Merida Cruz, joins me to talk about her new book, Read the Road Signs. Welcome and thank you for joining me. Now, I'm the interviewer here asking the questions, but on this occasion, I believe you have some questions for me.
I do. First of all, good evening and thank you for having me on your show. I do, Rick, and am I okay to ask you them questions? Obviously, it's role reversed this evening.
Absolutely.
Okay, so my book is called Read the Road Signs. And some people are quite confused about the title because, first of all, when my book was published, it went in the section of the traffic section. And obviously, it's a relationship book. So people can sometimes think that it's about traffic when it's not. But have you ever been driving down the motorway, Rick, and you've missed your exit, you've missed your turning, and that moment reaches when you get to the junction and you think, oh, I need to get off here, and you miss it. And you think to yourself, should I risk it? And you look in your own mirror and you think, no, I'm going to have to stay on the motorway. Have you ever been in that position?
Actually, fairly recently. And because I was travelling up the motorway, or in this case, the dual carriageway, in the opposite direction that I would normally travel in when going to IKEA, and I missed my turn off. And I wasn't immediately aware that I had until I noticed one or two signs and thought, I've missed a turn off. The dual carriageway was on. It doesn't have it. There isn't any option of someone having a fly U-turn or whatever. But I can understand how some people may be tempted to do that.
What my book teaches people to do is to pick up the signs and be present in the moment so that they don't end up missing their exit and wasting another 3 years of their life in the wrong situation or relationship.
Quite often one of the signs that you pick up on after the event is that the person is actually being extra nice to you.
Absolutely, because, and also you will find people accuse you of infidelity usually because they're being unfaithful or they're feeling some kind of guilt about the relationship failing, or if they have been unfaithful, then yes, I agree with you on that, Rick.
Now, moving on to the book itself, tell us a little bit of the story behind what made you write the book. What inspired you to write a book on this particular topic?
I think I'm passionate about mental health. Absolutely passionate about it. And I think, you know, I've mentioned to you before about if you break something physically, like an arm or a leg, and you neglect to get it fixed, then you could end up disabled. You could end up with your finger, if you don't have it straightened, it's disabled, or your finger is never the same again. And we endure so much with our emotional and relationships, and if we don't sort of work through them and the pain and the things that have happened to us in our life, then it can affect us, and I'm an advocate for that. And the reason I wrote the book is my whole life I fell into relationships. I didn't even realise how sort of sheltered I'd been until I found myself single. And I was in my late 30s, I was single. You know, none of my friends are single. I was in an age group where everyone's married, settled down. And I was in my sort of mid-30s, found myself single and back out on a dating scene. And I'd never had to date. I'd never gone on dates. I'd never used online dating. So really, my experience and how I was received as a single person allowed me to put pen to paper, but also a very personal experience with friends and family. And, you know, I'm from a family of eight, and we've always had relationship dramas in the house because I've got five sisters. And one of my sisters was really successful, younger sister, senior social worker, just been promoted, got a you know, lovely brand new convertible car through a promotion. She had two houses, and she'd been with a partner 10 years, and then the relationship dissolved and through infidelity. And because of that relationship breaking down, she went through such a hard time. We were worried about her, like seriously worried about her. And she ended up resigning from a job and moving in with my parents and basically losing most of the equity in her houses and ending up with a, you know, suitcase full of clothes back at my parents' house, you know, in her late 20s. And watching how that affected her and the relationship and all the other experiences, obviously my own, my friends, and just listening to people everywhere, the conversation is dominated by either, you know, if you're unhappy in a relationship or you want to get out of the relationship or, you know, and from being young, I obviously have come up with my own concepts that I've just naturally sort of my concepts in life and that I apply to dating. And so that is the reason I just thought I want to help people in my position. I want to help people who are ever in my sister's position to sort of do the self-work so they never find themselves in that position.
Now, I've jokingly hinted in my introduction that this is a book for the female reader. Is that the case, or is it a book for anyone?
That's an interesting question, Rick. The book is universal, and the concepts that I've created can be applied to both men and women. However, the book is written for women, and it's not for any particular reason. It's just that my bonds and the relationships and the experiences that I had were connected to women. And there's hundreds of years worth of experience in the book of people's short stories, their experiences throughout the book. So, you know, I've got men that have actually bought it and done reviews and rave about it. So, you know, it is marketed at women and written for women. However, like I said, the concepts are universal, and I'm sure that, you know, many did enjoy it too.
Well, it is a known fact, although many won't admit it, but it's a known fact that quite a number of men do actually enjoy reading articles in women's magazines, in particular on relationships and dating and all that sort of thing. So, you know, I think a lot of male readers will pick up the book and get as much out of it as any of the female readers. Now, that brings me to my next question. We have established that it's a book that has a lot to teach the reader. But if you could pick one thing out of the book that you would like the reader to learn or to take away, what would that one thing be?
Oh, I've got so many, but could I pick two?
You can pick two. Let's make it three.
I'll pick two. Three. Wow, that's great. Three. The first one is observe what you attract. Which comes into the concept of investing in yourself. And the thing I'm so passionate about is people will say, oh, you know, he's an idiot and I'm in the wrong relationship and he's this and he's that. And they will fail to hold the mirror up to themselves. And the thing I'm really passionate about is if you are attracting idiots all the time and having the same pattern of relationships, then it's time to observe what you attract and understand why. And only until you understand why and do self-work, and if that's going for counselling or CBT, and understanding why you attract unhealthy scenarios, why you always end up either being the parent in the relationship or you end up with the same outcome all the time where they end up, the relationship ends up dissolving and they end up running off with another woman. There's reasons why. And what I'm passionate about and want to teach my readers is to clean their canvas and understand if you're trying to start a new relationship on a painting, for example, if you had a painting in the gallery and it's already got a painting on, then you're never going to have a true reflection of what that relationship is. So what I teach people is to clean the canvas, do the self-work, and then they will attract the right relationships. The second one is I talk about investing in yourself. And if I said to you, Rick, or say, for example, we were married and I said, oh, like, you know, should we buy a new kitchen for, you know, the new kitchen is going to cost us $5,000-$10,000. But most probably, you know, we'd budget, we'd look at it and it'd be a reasonable sort of investment. But if I were to say to you, you know, why don't you invest £1,000 on a course that you've always wanted to do, or £2,000 on something that's really important to you? Most people will not invest in themselves. And what I talk about is, you are your most valuable asset. You know, of course your house is important, but you are the most important asset. So invest in yourself. And by investing in yourself, I talk about, that might mean one of my friends had a really, really large bust, and it caused her no end of grief. She had backache all the time. She couldn't wear certain clothes. And what she did is she saved up, invested in herself, and it's completely changed her life. And what I talk about is changing your perspective onto you and investing in you. And this, lastly, is I talk about dressing in self-esteem. When I talk about, if you dress in self-esteem daily, instead of, we talk about dressing in fancy clothes, and don't get me wrong, I love fancy clothes and, you know, nice dresses. But the most attractive thing that I've learned in life is dressing in self-esteem. If you walk out of your door every day with self-esteem and think like a 10, which is also in my book, then you know, you can't go wrong. That they're three powerful messages that I talk about in my book.
Very wise words. Many people may think, when, you know, hearing about your book, they may think, oh, this is just another relationship or dating book. What would you say to change their minds? What would you say makes your book stand out?
My book stands out because I've been a single parent. I brought a son up on my own. I've faced adversity, quite a lot of adversity in my life. I've been in a predominantly male environment, working with men for 14 years, 15 actually in June, where I've been the only female exposed to men and how they talk and how they think. And I've listened to conversations and thought to myself, if only the girl would do this, or if only she would do that. And through them over the years, it's obviously pushed me into putting pen to paper and writing about it. I can also say my book is really unique and different because I wrote it, and there's only one me. And I also feel that the stories in the book, well, the short stories in the book, were people's experiences. There's hundreds of years of experience in that book. And if you could invest, if I could have, for $9.99, 100 years worth of solid advice and experience from people who have been there and done it, that to me is investing in yourself. You wouldn't think twice about paying $9.99 for a new T-shirt or, you know, a new CD, when this is about gaining knowledge, isn't it, and insight into to different people's lives. And that's what I'd say is different about my book, Rick.
Now, I should reassure our listeners, when you're talking about over 100 years of experience, now you're not giving away your age there.
No.
Now, talking about messages, if I asked you for three words that highlight or best describe what makes the right person for the right relationship, what would those three words be?
I think that's a difficult question, Rick. That's a good question. I like that. The thing is, we're all unique, aren't we? So it's really difficult to say the three things, but, you know, it's something that comes naturally. And there's got to be respect, mutual respect, and mutual attraction. And most of all, to me, the key to a solid relationship is there has to be humour and laughter. And, you know, they're the key things, ingredients that I think are important. But everybody's different. And it's really difficult to answer that question, Rick, because I can only speak for what I think is important, not what's universally important to people. To you, it might be really important through your experiences in your life to have somebody who's honest. That might be your key thing. So it's all about trust, having trust. And the key thing, I think, to meeting someone is them bringing out your best.
Absolutely. Now, going back to the book itself, tell me about some of the challenges that you faced when you made that decision to sit down and write the book. And on the other side of the coin, what you found the most rewarding aspect of writing the book?
The most difficult thing about writing the book was, I'm not a professional writer. I had a professional job. So I embarked on a course and went on some weekends to sort of see where to start. It's actually finding the time to be in the mood to write, because, you know, it doesn't come easy. People think, you know, you can sit and write. You have to be in the mood to write. So what I found is, and my dad gave me some advice, is just take a sort of notebook around with you and make sort of notes, you know, when it's spontaneously. So I think finding the time and committing yourself to sitting down and committing was the thing I found most difficult. But the highlight, I have to say, my book only came, it was available in December. And since then, I've got 5-star review on Amazon. And I was never on social media, mainly because of my day job. And I only joined sort of, I've not been on there, I think, about 8 months. And through social media, I've sort of done a little bit of advertising for my book. And I've had some amazing messages from women and feedback, which is, I can't tell you how good that made me feel to know that somebody appreciated what I did. And it helped them, and that felt amazing, and that's been the most rewarding thing.
What are your plans for the future, as far as writing is concerned?
As far as writing, I definitely want to, I've had loads of ideas about scripts and writing throughout my life, and I definitely want to do another book, absolutely. And I definitely need to sort of get started with that, but first of all, I'd like to, you know, sort of take this as far as I can, as getting it the right exposure, and hopefully helping as many people as I can. But yeah, I definitely would like to continue writing.
That's wonderful. In closing, is there anything that you would like to add that we haven't talked about that you feel is important for people to know about your book and about the message that your book has for the reader?
It's really difficult to describe what the book's about. The book's really easy to read because it's not... As a reader, I'm not an avid reader myself, which is ironic, isn't it, considering I wrote a book, is I found it difficult when there was big chunks and small writing. You know, I found it too much to sort of commit myself to reading. So my book I've made quite easy to read. They're in small, short, sharp sections, so it's really easy to read. And it's relatable. It's real life, Rick. It's not, you know, I'm just a village girl, you know, who's been exposed to so many things in my life. You wanted to share it and try and make a difference. So, and I can guarantee when somebody's finished reading that book, if they're single or trying to be in a relationship that they're happy with, I can guarantee they will feel good and inspired by the time they've finished reading it.
Wonderful, and thank you for that. Read the Road Signs is published by Lulu and is available direct from the publisher at lulu.com and all good book stockers. Once again, many thanks to my guest today, the author Merida Cruz, for joining me on the subject of dating relationships. And I think, to summarise it, about people. This is Rick Bell for Toggenet Radio. Thank you for listening.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages.
Have you heard? The pages of American Patchwork and Quilting magazine come to life on our new weekly online radio show, American Patchwork and Quilting. Join Pat Sloan, our blogging and quilt designer host, as she talks about the latest trends, ideas, and inspirations. Her guests include quilt pattern designers, authors, quilt shop owners, and our editors. All quilters, just like you. Call in with your questions. Get quilting tips from industry experts. Learn about free patterns. Hear behind-the-scenes stories from our magazines, American Patchwork and Quilting, Quilt Sampler, and Quilts and More. Get the scoop on free stuff and find out more about the best independent quilt shops in North America. To listen to a live show, tune in Monday at 4 p.m. Eastern. Just log on to allpeoplequilt.com/radio. To hear past shows, go to iTunes and search for American Patchwork and Quilting Radio. We hope you'll join us because we know that quilting changes everything.
Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, Out of the Ashes Came Hope, and the author is Monsignor William J. Linder, written with the help of Gilda Rogers, and we have Monsignor on the line with us. Hello, Monsignor.
Hello, how are you today?
Great to have you with us, and this is quite a story. Of course, your story, your experiences that take us all the way back to the 1960s in Newark, New Jersey. And just to remind everyone, at that time, Newark, New Jersey was in an intense challenges, racial challenges, right?
Yes. In fact, Time magazine said it was the worst city in the United States.
So the worst city in the United States that eventually erupts in riots in 1967. And here in 1963, you're thrown into that as the only white person probably that is there to help all of these folks, who African-Americans, who have struggled in poverty for just such a long time. So take us back. When it first happened, when you were assigned there, what were you feeling?
Well, the first day I got there, you know, you always reported first to the chancery office for the archdiocese, and I got an envelope which had my assignment in it, and you couldn't see it until you got out of the room. And when I got in the street, I looked and I saw a Queen of Angels. And I knew it was an African-American parish, but it was known for its tremendous, being very progressive. The pastor there had been the procurator at the seminary, and had before that been at Christ the King in an African-American parish in Jersey City. And he was very comfortable there, and was doing all kinds of things. We were right in the middle of public housing. We had about 25,000 people living in high-rise public housing, and we were right in the middle of it. And it was a great experience because everybody was new. The whole parish were actually new Catholics, so they really didn't have any long traditions. So you didn't have to worry about how people, how they wanted to do things. They were open to anything new. And so we created ourselves.
Well, you had to create out of literally hopelessness, didn't you? You had to lift these people to the fact and to the thinking that change could come.
Yeah, well, I think that's true. They certainly were very depressed. It was a very depressed community, and for good reasons. And we had to really challenge people that we could make a difference.
And so you did that, as you put it. You started one of the largest community development organizations in the United States, and you did it with a group of ordinary concerned residents.
Correct.
And that was the genesis of tremendous progress.
Oh, made a great impact in the city. And it was interesting that outside, the people we needed help from really were very much motivated that people got together and were doing things. And they wanted to help. Everybody wanted to help, whether it be on the state level or even the federal level.
So you embarked on this task of epic proportions to rebuild Newark's Central Ward, because it had been destroyed in the 67 riots.
Right. Well, it was the worst area of what was considered the worst city in the nation.
Well, let's talk about some specifics, some different people along the way. Tell us about when you first met Joe, is it Channyfield?
It was the first day I arrived at Queen of Angels. And, of course, you'd be dressed in your black suit and black shoes, shined, and, you know, looking real sharp. And first thing, I had trouble getting in the rectory. No one answered the door. So finally I got in, and then the pastor took me on a tour. And the first place he went in the back, and the men were digging a trench for a sewer system. We had no sewer system, and we had a school that the men had really fixed over. It was an old school, and we opened up, and they opened up another parochial school, and it was packed. And the kids would play in the playground, but it was all rough stone, and the kids would get hurt every lunch hour. And what you do is you carry a pocket of Band-Aids all the time. The men decided that they're going to change that and pave it, but before they could, they would have to put this water sewer system in. And they were in the middle of it and digging trenches. And I got there, and one of the men, Joe Cheneyfield, challenged me. He said, "Get out of those shoes and suit and get in here and work." So I went, and I changed and put my... And I used to work all my summers in construction, so I was very comfortable with that. And I jumped in the pitch into the, ditch with them, and started working alongside them. And I spent the day there working with them. Well, after that, we became the greatest of friends. And in fact, a fantastic friend to me. Later on, certainly meant a lot in the rest of my priesthood. Because Joe was a very interesting guy, tremendously physically powerful. He had, down south, worked as a lumberjack and had to work as a kid, really, because his family had no one to take care of him, and he was the only source of income. And so others in the family all went on to do all kinds of interesting things. One was a tap dancer. Cheney was kind of known at the time. And his family were very successful, and Joe was the only guy that stayed. He was successful later on his own way. He became president of the local union, and he was the type of guy people had a great deal of confidence in.
So you helped develop black leadership in the community.
Yep, local there, right there, lived in the projects. In fact, I live right, I live in the nursing home, but if I ever got out of here, I live right where the parking lot was in the building he lived in.
How many years were you there? How many years were you assigned there as the priest?
Well, the first parish, 10 years. And then later, I was 38 years in St. Rose of Lima as pastor. And I owe that to Archbishop Garrity because I was always in trouble. And the way he used to talk, we had got to get you regularized. And regularized meant that I got a regular assignment in the diocese. And it ended up as pastor of the parish. You know, not a great deal in number of people wanted to be pastors of those parishes. And so I got it, and then he did it under the old canon law, which meant that it was protected, which wouldn't be under the new canon law. So it was later on when I had difficulties again with the bishop. There wasn't anything he could do because I was protected. And in the first case, when Archbishop Boland brought charges against me and they went to Rome, they didn't do well. And so I knew I was very much protected, and I could afford to be radical.
Well, it often takes a radical person to make radical changes and to improve a situation. You established what is called the New Community Corporation. Tell us about that and the mission statement and about your success.
Well, originally what we decided were two things, that we had to create our own corporation, because at that time all the big developers were getting huge commitments of land in Newark for future development, even though they weren't developing most cases because there was no development going on. The mayor made commitments to them, and we felt that we had to have a local corporation, which was ours, and we had to do that. Development had to be done by the people. And I was at Fordham at the time, going on for my, what eventually became going on for my doctorate. It wasn't then. I just wanted to go to take some courses. And I did a paper on leadership in Newark, black leadership in Newark, and I had a list of names, and I approached them all and asked them, would they be on a corporation? They said yes. So we, all of them became part of our original corporation, and although what we called the advisory board, which was the local people, they really ran it. The others were like trustees. And but they were a good group of people in both cases. I had great people. And we began then to take on, the first project was Judge Housing, because that's what seemed to be the most important thing in the eyes of the people. And we did that first. And that began a huge development. We now have over 2,000 units of senior housing alone. So it's it grew into something very massive. And in fact, at one point, it was the new community was the largest community development corporation in the country, and actually did a lot of international work with it. We did work as the Berlin Wall went down and Eastern Europe opened up. We were asked by the federal government to do work with community groups, which were just beginning in Eastern Europe, because they didn't have any. You know, the Soviet Republic did not encourage people doing their own thing.
Well, you had already proven yourself, so they knew they could count on you. Let's talk about the leadership, which we've just discussed a bit. Often there was intense feelings amongst the leaders in some of the meetings, and you talk about your first employee, Cecilia, and she'd often have to get right in the middle of it to stop some interesting situations.
Yes, well, Cecilia's still around and still active, and in fact, I just saw her yesterday.
Well, you talk about her breaking up a fight in one of the meetings.
I know we had a battle with the president was Willie Wright, who was the most radical guy in our city, and Joe Chaneyfield, same one we were just talking about. And Willie was doing his thing as he did, you know, kind of almost like a Donald Trump, and his ego was great. And Joe decided to put him down, and Joe had him against the wall ready to kill him. And Celia stepped in and got between them, and Joe is very gentle with women, and he backed off.
Well, it takes a lot of passion to make changes. You have to have those types of people often, and great, great, interesting folks who work side by side with you. And I want to end our discussion about your book, Out of the Ashes Came Hope, about hope. You have a chapter in part 3 that's titled Hope, the Most Spontaneous Prayer There Is. Tell us about that kind of hope.
Well, I think, you know, in the case here, the only thing that people had was hope for the future. You know, they certainly weren't living it, you know, and it was the hope in the sense of what we could do together. And that's the hope I'm talking about. And that actually was very much tied to their religious thing. God, it was God-given, and no one could take it from them. You know, no one could take hope from them. They could do a lot of things to them, but they couldn't take hope from them. And that kept us together. And that really, you know, was the glue that put us together. And so we began to build on that. It wasn't that we had something. It was what we thought we could get if we worked together.
Well, when you're unified, one and one doesn't make two anymore. It makes 3 or 4 or 5, doesn't it? That synergy happens.
Very much so. Very much.
Well, Monsignor, we really appreciate you joining us on Indie Book Publishing. We've been listening to Monsignor William J. Linder. His book, Out of the Ashes Came Hope. Tell us the best way to get your book, Monsignor.
Well, I guess, you know, you can get it in all the usual places, Barnes and Noble, or they can get it through New Community. Amazon.com, which I use.
All the retail outlets online, and I'm sure you could probably walk into a store and ask for it as well, and they could order it if they didn't have it. So, Monsignor, what a story, your memoir of a life filled with service and a great example to all of us. And I think what I hear from you is that it's not only what you did, it's what you did together with all these great people.
Yeah, my job was just to be kind of the cheerleader.
Well, it sounds like you were a great one. Thank you, Monsignor.
Thank you.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages.
It's the Fitness Minute with fitness expert Annette Hammond.
When your focus is to lose weight or maintain your present weight, exercising effectively to burn the most calories is crucial. You want to give yourself every advantage to burn as many calories as possible. One good tip is to do your strength training exercises standing up so you can keep your heart rate up. Another tip is to perform multi-joint exercises when you can. For example, as you're doing a forward lunge, add bicep curls while you're coming up from the lunge. Another example is to execute a wide squat, and as you're coming up from the squat, perform a shoulder press. By doing these multi-joint exercises, you're putting more demands on your body, keeping your heart rate up, and working more muscles at the same time. The goal is to burn the most calories during that workout. I'm Annette Hammond. To hear other fitness and weight loss tips, visit our website at AnnetteHammond.com.
Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, Nothing Good Happens at the Baby Hospital, The Strange, Silly World of Pediatric Brain Surgery. And the author is Dr. Daniel Fulkerson. And Dr. Fulkerson joins us now on Indie Book Publishing. And this interview is brought to you by Archway Publishing. Hello, Doctor.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Well, great to have you on the show. Nothing good happens at the baby hospital. I think we probably all would stand up and say, how could anything good happen at the baby hospital when you're dealing with brain surgery? It's so overwhelming, but you've got an amazing background in this area, and we'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment. But as you point out, children show remarkable courage in the face of tragedy. And then, of course, your book is just filled with examples of the serious and tragic as well as the silly and funny.
You know, a lot of the funny situations are, as we train for medicine, you know, a lot of times we're thrown into situations where we're really over our head, and a lot of crazy things happen to people as they get formed, especially as they're going through the process of becoming a surgeon. And you're exactly right. You know, I think the main reason that I wanted to write this is every day I get to meet remarkable kids and remarkable families who are going through just unbelievable challenges, and their ability to bounce back from that or to find humor in it is something that I've always found very inspiring.
So your book is filled with patient stories, as you point out, their triumphs and their tragedies, but it's inspiring. I mean, that's really what you're trying to accomplish here is the heights that people can rise to in the midst of the worst possible moment of their lives.
Right, and now kids or adults who are going through neurosurgery or having brain surgery or have something, brain tumor or trauma, you know, that's a lot of times the worst time in their life. I think a lot of those cases are extremely interesting, obviously, something that I wanted to go into for my whole life. And there's been some other books about that, but usually they're very, they're just tragedy. And one of the things I wanted to do is highlight all the fun that comes, all the, you know, the laughter and some of the victories. So this is hopefully something that a person with no medical background would be able to read and be entertained by, laugh at some things and, come out of it feeling hopeful and happy that they read it.
You're an associate professor of neurological surgery at the Indiana University School of Medicine. You're also the assistant residency program director in the university's Department of Neurological Surgery. When you first started, when you were in training, what was that like? There must have been all extremes in that kind of environment.
Right. And the book starts out with the first chapter was my introduction to neurosurgery. And I was just a total neophyte, a medical student. And this professor got up and just gave me a lecture that I can probably recite verbatim now 20 years later. And one of the other things about the book is, nobody gets to the point where they're allowed to operate on the brain without being very inspired and molded by the people that came before them. And so a lot of the book also talks about the characters that basically mentored me and a bunch of other people who have gone through training. And I find their personalities and their passion for teaching to be something that I thought was entertaining and would be relatable to other people. So there's a lot of steps that go through it, from medical school to residency to fellowship training, and all these steps that one has to do to earn the right to be able to operate on someone's nervous system. For me, there was also a little detour for a four-year overseas stint to the United States military, and anybody who's been in the military knows all the kind of weird situations that one can be put into. So that's in there too.
Tell us about this professor. You describe him like Eeyore from Winnie the Pooh.
Well, he's got a very, very distinct voice, and he's got a very distinct posture, and he's been probably my biggest influence in neurosurgery and myself and many others over the last 25, 30 years. So he's the residency director, and I'm his assistant now. But he's one of those characters that's larger than life, and the nice thing for me to try to tell his story is I don't have to exaggerate a single thing. So he's somebody that is just very unforgettable, and he does have a very distinctive voice. It sounds remarkably like Eeyore from Winnie the Pooh.
Well, it takes these kinds of people with this great ability and at the same time this great skills to motivate people to their highest moment, because obviously when you're in the midst of brain surgery, I can't even imagine the focus and the feeling that you must have, what's going on inside of you, especially operating on children.
Yeah, and it's a special poignancy with the children. The feeling, the one of the things about the book that I hope conveys is our job, we have the most tremendous highs and the deepest lows. And when you have a patient that does well, or you're able to help them, or they're able to recover from some horrible thing, there's really no better feeling than that professionally. And likewise, when you have somebody that either you can't help or, things don't go the way you expect, there's nothing that's more devastating. So one of the things I want the reader to do is to experience that and go through the roller coaster that all of us who are in this kind of field feel every day. And it's a very, it can be very powerful, can be sometimes overwhelming, but at the end of the day, when you have a patient that does well and comes back to see you smiling and they're over their whatever they came in for, that's a tremendous, tremendous feeling.
Tell us about the influence that Thomas, as you call him, had on you. Reminds us of a skinny Santa Claus, you point up.
Yeah. Yeah, he's another one of one of my biggest influences, especially in going to pediatrics. So he is a guy who was somewhat tortured by genius. His mental abilities were just so far above everybody else's, and that was almost a hindrance to him. And he was the heart and soul of the baby hospital for 27 years. And part of that was he was so much fun, which I hope to, you know, convey. And we had so many good times together. And his patients are tremendously devoted to this day, still ask me, you know, about him. And his patients created a fan page on the internet, which I'm not sure many doctors have that. And he just shows how big an influence he has in many people's lives. However, as modern medicine evolved, his ways sort of were chewed up, and he became kind of caught up in the medical environment, which is somewhat hostile. And, you know, I think he ended up being a bit of a tragic hero because some of the, you know, tougher parts of the medical environment really caught up to him. And so he's been one of my most influential people, and I think people will enjoy reading about him. He's another one of those characters that, well, you don't have to exaggerate a thing. He's just a larger-than-life figure that everybody recognizes.
Well, in such a serious environment that you are in all the time, it takes people to lighten it up, I'm sure. And in training, as you point out, there's more ridiculous moments than you can probably count. And so share some stupid, ridiculous moment and maybe embarrassing moment in training.
Well, one of the things when you're the lowest person and the lowest person in medical school, you get sent to the most sort of disgusting cases. And I'll never forget as a junior student getting thrown into the emergency department of the county hospital. And so you're patching people up and you're dealing with prisoners and drunk people, and people are, you know, throwing up on every place. And you know, one of my colleagues got called in to take care of an abscess in a patient, and this was in a particularly tender area. And that was his job was basically to hold the patient's cheeks apart, and I'm not talking about the cheeks by your mouth, so that the surgical intern could basically stick it with a knife. And the surgical intern was also a newbie and didn't realize that that was under a tremendous amount of pressure. And so when they stuck it, it came flying out all over everything, and that led to just a total mess. And those kind of situations, all of us who've trained can look back and say, oh yeah, I remember when I got sprayed by pus and everybody started throwing up. So those are situations that we all go through that in retrospect we can kind of laugh about.
Well, as we conclude talking about the book Nothing Good Happens at the Baby Hospital, Doctor, tell us about a child you'll never forget because it didn't end the way everyone prayed and hoped for.
Sure. One of the frustrating things, and something actually that just happened a couple weeks ago, is there are some particular types of tumors that can show up in kids, and we really have zero effective treatment. And those are always just soul-crushing, because you'll see a child, and they will not look that sick. They'll have double vision, or their balance will be a little bit off, and you'll see their MRI and just know that you're going to do your best you can and you're going to try everything you have, but they're not going to survive a year. And that, to me, is one of the most devastating things to have to tell a family and tell, you know, mom and tell dad. And basically you're helpless because there's not much you can do. And so those are things that, you know, really take you down to the lowest low, because you feel like, boy, you know, there's nothing we can do for this poor child. And, you know, one of the pieces of advice that Thomas gave me was, you know, you have to take so much joy out of the people that do well that it can block out the pain of the people that can't. And, you know, one of the most poignant stories, I think, of the book is talking about a child with just such a problem and the things that their family went through. And when you discuss that, there's no way to look at that without asking some of the big questions, you know, the meaning of life type questions.
Mm-hmm.
And families all ask those questions. And, you know, I wish I had better answers for them, but I like to try to record what they're asking. And that's one of, I think, the most poignant chapters in the book.
Well, let's end on a triumph. Let's end on someone who's still in your mind of you got finished and you still look back on it, not only with the procedure, all everything went well, but just the feeling of the parents, the family, the child, you, everyone that was involved. It just must be more than you can put into words.
Well, one of my favorite kids is a kid who was born with looked like a severe congenital problem. And, you know, looking at his initial scans, thought, boy, this kid's never going to really do anything. He's not going to be a kid that can walk and talk. And we operated on him early, and he just exceeded all expectations. And so when he was like 2 years of age, every morning when he would wake up, the first thing out of his mouth is his name was Ben in the book, and he would yell, "Yay, Ben!" And that was the way he started every day. He just seemed, you know, happy to be alive and just celebrating. And so he came back and he got sick, and we worked on him, and boy, things just didn't seem like they were going well. And then finally we hit on the right note, and when I walked into his room and he just opened his eyes and say, "Yay, Ben!" And, you know, that's what it's all about, and that's where it's very gratifying. So that little kid wakes up every day in a way that would make all the self-help people smile, I guess.
The title of the book, Nothing Good Happens at the Baby Hospital, The Strange, Silly World of Pediatric Brain Surgery. Dr. Fulkerson, tell us the best way to get your book.
It's on Amazon, it's on Barnes & Noble, on Books A Million, and I hope people enjoy it.
Well, thank you so much for joining us on Indie Book Publishing.
Thank you very much for having me.
And this interview has been brought to you by Archway Publishing.
You've been listening to Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen. Join us again next week at noon Eastern as Steve interviews another great author.